Hey there. Welcome to Scott Caparo's podcast, Scott Caparo Probes. This week, I'm being probed by my friend Andy, who produces and promotes and books a brilliant comedy night in London called Comedy Unleashed, which is a free-thinking, free-speaking comedy show. I've performed it a few times. And some clips of my work from my most recent appearance at Comedy Unleashed will appear in this interview. I just thought it might be good for me to express where I'm coming from. This being my show, some people listening might, believe it or not, have no idea who I am or what I do. So it might give a more interesting perspective to see through my viewpoint, from my prism, how I view comedy and how I work. So there'll be three comedy clips, one right after this intro, before the interview between Andy and I begin, and then another clip somewhere through the middle of the interview, and then at the end. So stay tuned, and thanks again for tuning in to Scott Caparo's podcast. And tune in next week when I'll be interviewing some comedians in Holland. I know, get her, right? Dutch people can be funny, or can they? On the next Scott Caparo Probes. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. I'm in mourning, actually. That's why I'm wearing mostly black. I'm queer, so I have to wear a flash of color. But, or else they take my membership card away from me. But I'm wearing... Because some Mormon people... Namaste. You may have read about this. 9 Mormons died in the northern part of Mexico yesterday, right? In a drive-by shooting or some sort of thing. And 2 women, which means that at least one husband lost wives. And luckily, they're replaceable. That's the bright side. But anyway...
Hello, I'm not Scott Caparo, but I am going to be doing the probing in this particular exchange. On Scott Caparo Probes. And with me, I have Scott, who is himself going to be probed.
Hello. I've not been probed on this show before. It's a big night for the two of us, I think. Oh, well, that's Alexa. She's nervous. Relax, Alexa. It'll be fine. It'll be fine.
Alexa, who would you like to be probed?
Usually I probe
people. I don't have an opinion on that.
Oh, see? Alexa's easy. Usually... I asked the questions, but I just thought it might be interesting to probe a bit of my work so maybe the listening audience doesn't know what I do, has a bit more familiarity with who I am and what I'm about.
Yeah, cool. Well, you've just come back from San Francisco, mm-hmm. Scott, where you spent a bit of time with fellow comedians and you did some sets yourself.
It's my hometown, yes. And I went back to check in on my father, who's still alive. And then, yes, I did some shows. And it's interesting, I saw a lot of comedy, and I saw a comedian who's gone back on the circuit, who left the circuit for many years to produce and write television, and it's interesting to watch him now because he's still as confrontational and as sort of wild as he was on stage when I saw him maybe 20 years ago.
Wow!
But the audience's response was very quiet. His jokes were brilliantly crafted and mostly about current social mores, but mm-hmm. people, even though I knew they were fans of his, were really thrown aback by how direct he was, and he kept having to remind them it was a comedy show. And I was sitting in the back with a friend of mine. We were falling off our chairs laughing. He was so smart. But you know, people, maybe it was a holiday season, they didn't know what to expect and they wanted something a bit lighter. I don't know.
So do you think maybe it was a bit of a touristy audience or...
I don't think so. I think they knew who he was.
What sort of club was it?
It's a large mainstream club called The Punchline. And I'm pretty sure they knew him. He's very well known. But I also felt like he was mining some personal details as well. And I think that both helped and hindered him. I think it's interesting when you go from your own personal experience back to political stuff or confronting people with their own hypocrisy, it can feel like really jarring, which I love because I don't want to know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
But I think some people would rather feel like they were being taken along for a ride, but they were in the car with you mm-hmm. and they could see through the windshield ahead what direction you were going.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with this person, that was not available to them.
So all they want to know is, have we arrived yet, Daddy? Rather than, where are you taking us? This is exciting.
Yeah.
Which is actually much more what you are, is you're never quite sure. Well, sorry, I'm never quite sure where you're going to go. Well, so, and that actually makes the whole, it makes it a much more enlivening experience.
It was I'm watching this person because I could tell him he changed gears about two thirds the way through his set, and he actually said, "I'm not going to tell you that bit because I don't think you guys would like it." And then he moved on to something else, which was funny, but didn't follow the thread of what he'd been talking about, which is, you know, kind of our own nihilism and our own sort of, what is it, enlarged view of ourselves, where we're so important, you know. And his claim was that we make things sound worse than they actually are, which you and I were discussing.
He's got a point.
Yeah, he does. And he said things don't have to be as bad as you want them to be.
Yeah.
Every time he tells something. And he's telling stories around that thing, which were hilarious stories, where people had over-exaggerated or had misrepresented themselves. And it was making the audience extremely
Maybe the audience wants to, you know, feel like things are really bad and they need to be taken or care really of a little good. Bit more. And
Yeah. I think that, you know, before my mother died, she found it difficult to talk to me because I have a hard time with casual conversation, but also I'm not great at overselling or underselling something, and I don't like taking sides necessarily. Mm-hmm. Like if someone's telling me something about themselves, I'm not going to say, "Oh, that's awful." Or people talk about their divorces or their kids or their marriage problems. I'm not going to take, you know, it's none of my business really. And I ask questions that, you know, might get me kicked out of the dining room, but I just...
Well, because they're interesting to you rather than you're just console people. And
I remember my mom telling me something about something going on in her life. And I said, you know, it sounds like you're powerless.
Yeah. Insightful.
Everything she told me, I can't fix it. I can't make it better. I just said, it sounds like you feel. And she's like, I'm going to show my power now. Get in your car and go back to San Francisco. I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, you're not staying here this weekend. Get the fuck out of my house. Right?
You cured her. I mean, the thing is, that's the point. She was powerless. And you empowered her.
You know, the thing... I thought you said you killed her. You're right, I cured her. You know, one of the best things, my friend, when I was dealing with my citizenship stuff in the UK, I got really frustrated. Sorry. And when the citizenship process is very difficult. Anyway, fair... to a certain extent, but difficult. And I was trying to do it this way or that way. And my friend Mark in California said, it was really important. He said, you know, it sounds like you're giving the power away to other people in this process. Mm-hmm. You need to find a way where you control it. I'm like, he's so right. I hadn't looked at it at all that way. And once I did that, it solved it. So maybe I was borrowing from Mark, but oftentimes I see performers on stage hand their power over to the audience in so many ways. Like, have you ever seen a comic give their microphone to an audience
member? Oh, my. That is mad.
Disaster. Or left them up on stage with you. Or apologize to them for something you've said. Or...
Well, that's the worst one. Yeah. And there's far too much of that going on.
Oh, yeah. Or tell them, I'm like you. That's a bad one. And I saw a comic in South London recently say to an Afro-Caribbean woman in the audience. She was British, but had Afro-Caribbean heritage. Mm-hmm. And first he said... what's your accent?
Right.
She said, it's South London, mate. What's yours?
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, my hair, he has curly hair. My hair is just like yours. You never discuss a woman's hair. Never mention her hair. Ever.
She spent a lot of money on that.
And she did. She
said, your hair is not like mine.
She said, actually, your hair is not like my hair, actually. Yeah. I don't know what
but he was. Can I touch it?
Oh, exactly. And then he said, isn't it great how Balaam has changed so much?
Oh. Well, the more people like me here. Gentrified. Is that what he meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
And, and the audience was, there were a majority of black people in the room.
Yeah.
And they were, every remark he said made things worse. And I'm like, dude, at the beginning of the show, bringing me on first, I'm like, just tell the jokes. Just tell the jokes. They don't, you're not like them. You're not.
Yeah.
At all.
Well, it's lovely how he's trying to prove that he was, and everything he was saying, such a proving he had no understanding.
Nothing! And that could be funny as well if he were doing that as a shit.
Intentionally.
Yes.
That'd be brilliant. In fact, he's invented his best character and he doesn't even know it because he's too stupid.
Oh.
But the thing is, Scott, you command the stage. Every time I've seen you, the audience has to come with you whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
And it is quite important to you to do that and also not be predictable, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think one way that I don't try to not be predictable, but one thing I try to do is talk about current events, which I think some comics don't cover and audience members are nervous hearing about, but I like that. And I think that you have to sort of give the room a chance to play along. Like, I would never, what I try not to do is listen to the show before I go on, because I don't want to walk up there with a notion. Oftentimes you go to a set, a comedy show, and the host will say, oh, in the front row, there's a couple from whatever, from Kingston, and they're both lawyers. And to your left are some, are three students, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, don't tell, please, please, don't tell me anything. I don't want to know. I'll figure all of it out myself. I don't want to go up there and, oh, and this, those people have been difficult. And this, I'm like, really, just really, that all happened 20 minutes ago, you know? So I don't want to edit myself because of what's happened in the past of that show. I have a particular, that's why when I go to watch shows, if I'm doing an out of town gig and I have to get there early because I have a driver, it's a real pain. Not because I lose my energy sitting for 2 hours, but also because I see everything that happens before me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see any of that. I don't want to see any of it. Because every set, because, you know, in Britain there's breaks, not in the US. It would be easier in the US, but here there's breaks. And the audience refresh at the break and they start over again.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't need to refer to what's happened in the past. In America, maybe a little bit more because there's table service, so you don't take breaks. The shows are shorter, and it's easier to do a callback or refer to something if you prefer to. But in the show here, where you take a break after each comic,
which do you prefer?
You know, if I'm doing three or four shows a night, obviously the breaks,
yeah,
because it gives you more time. But in the U.S., I really enjoy because I like doing longer sets. So usually I'm closing, and I like to go on for between 45 minutes and an hour. I really enjoy that. And it gives me time to chat with the audience a bit, and it gives me a chance to do new stuff at the beginning. I always do my new stuff at the top, which is not what a lot of people like to do. But I like to do it early on because it exhilarates me. But also, if I fuck up, I can catch them again. Back. Yeah.
And what new stuff are you working on at the moment? And when I say working, I mean, you know, you might... In fact, how do you work? Do you just... Because you run.
Yeah.
You're going to do a 10-mile run tomorrow.
I'm going to
do... And do you write stuff as you go?
No.
No?
God, I don't wear headphones. No, I turn my brain off. I don't...
No, but do you think? I mean, do you...
No. No.
So when does your material come to you?
When I'm working.
You sit down and work?
Nah, sometimes. If I'm working in an Edinburgh set, I might sit down and write it out. But really, I've talked to other comics about this. The comedians I know that have mentioned it to me, we only write when we're working. Really, if I'm on the road, if I'm playing, I'll be at the Manchester Comedy Store next weekend. I'll be doing like six shows in three different clubs. Four different clubs, actually. One's a theater, three clubs. I'll be writing a lot then.
But you sit down and write?
How
does it come to you?
Usually I'll be having a meal somewhere, and if I'm in Manchester, I'll be having lunch. I'll overhear a story I think is funny, someone telling a story to somebody, and I might twist it in some way, or my sister might call me and tell me something, and I might turn that into a story, or I'm writing stuff about my dad, so I might, usually I get up in the morning, and my head's clear.
Yeah.
And as I'm having coffee, or in the restaurant downstairs at the hotel, I'll write about five jokes. And I will read stuff in the paper, write stuff about that, and I will ask the guys who work in the Manchester Comedy Store, who work there, the bar staff, what's going on in Manchester right now. Last time I was there, they were finding a lot of corpses in the canal.
Oh,
this canal runs right outside the Comedy Store, but it runs all the way through Manchester.
Yeah.
And they weren't sure and they're mostly men. And the police weren't looking for corpses. They were looking for cell phones because people drop their cell phones in the canal a lot. So the cops jump in with rubber shoes and they'll kick something. It's a body. And they're not sure if the guy's falling because they're drunk, or if it's suicide, because the suicide rates are up amongst young people.
Yeah.
Or if it's murders, because there's so many gangster problems in Manchester. And they can't really tell until they drag the body out and see it. Then they can maybe tell if it's a gangster, if they've been shot in the back of the head, execution style. But oftentimes they think it's just drunk people walking and falling in.
How did you turn that into a joke?
I can't remember now, but I did.
Come on, Scott.
You're going to tell us the joke. I knew you were going to ask me that, because it was last year.
You have to edit it back into this.
I do. And I probably said something like, you know, living here, you know, that maybe I don't know, it's about seeing their own reflection in the water and jumping in. It's something about it, but it was all right. And it didn't have to be a brilliant joke. It just has to be a local reference. And you could do 10 minutes like that. There are, like, Paula Poundstone's a brilliant American comedian who's able to do that. There are others I know in the U.S. who could do it. And I'm sure I think Tom Wigglesworth is great at doing local stuff, and other comedians, I think, that can really work in a local element to what they do. It's brilliant. It's really the audience, I think, they're I think the audience
flattered by it.
Well, that's the word I was thinking for. I was going to say impressed, but you're right, it's flattered.
Yeah.
I think
Mark Steele does it really well.
He's great. God, he's great. He's one of my favorite comedians in the world. Every time I see him, I just think, why do I get on stage? I mean, I've never seen him doing the same set. Oh, he's good. His son's good, too.
Is he?
I didn't really know good.
What's his son called?
Elliot.
Okay.
He's great.
He plays politics, or is it?
He's still young. He's so young still, and he's so good. Super cute. Really, really bubbly on stage. He's great. No, it's just, Mark's, he really gives a shit, too.
Okay.
You know?
Well, no, he does, yeah. He does.
Yeah.
Yeah, in his own sweet way.
He's another one, I think. Even though he writes, I think he still writes for the Independent, but you can't grasp, not really, his politics.
I think you can pretty clearly.
Well,
he's not overly keen on leaving the European Union, from what I remember. It's
yeah, but I don't. But that subject seems to transcend, you know, party politics, because there are Labour people that want to
leave. Yeah, it's left and right. Yeah, it's beyond all that. But what about your politics, Scott? And I'm not asking about what your politics is, because actually, you know, if we're all honest, we're all a sort of mix of all different, you know, as you said, the sort of left-right thing, you know, has less meaning, certainly, than it used to. But, you know, you've been criticised in the past for, you know, why are you being so political? You know, you were saying before we started this interview that when you were in Cape Town, touring in Cape Town, Jason Stone said to you, well, Jason Wood, can't you just be entertaining? Scott, can't you just be entertaining? So why can you not just be entertaining?
Yeah, we were at lunch when they said that. And Jason and I were part of the gay and lesbian section of the Cape Town Comedy Festival. We were doing a show in a car showroom. A BMW showroom downstairs. It was so surreal. And there were other acts on the bill, but I was closing every night. So strange. And it, really interesting audience were coming into each night. A numerous trans population in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. At least there was then. And a lot of black trans people were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the comics on the bill, if not all, were white middle class people from other countries. And I noted that a lot of because the comedians on the bill were ignoring the fact that, A, we were part of the gay and lesbian section of a comedy festival, but also they were discussing the trans issues in the country, or the fact that one in three people in Durban has AIDS, or this is 2006, so the AIDS epidemic was still in full throttle.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't mentioning the fact that the future prime minister of the country, I think he's still in office.
Zuma?
He just left. Yes. Had just admitted to having had sex, although she claimed that she'd been raped by him, with a local HIV AIDS activist who was also a friend of his family's, but she was HIV positive. And he said, oh no, I'm fine. This isn't in the trial for rape, because I washed with beetroot juice. So that was a big case at the time, and I wrote about 10 minutes on it.
Mm.
And the audience seemed to respond to it, but no one else in the bill was talking about it. And I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do those things. Anyway, after the first night, the two men who ran the show, who said they were heterosexual, but every night drove off together in their white BMW to laughing with their heads thrown back and the top down. Well, the top.
Their top's off.
There might not have been a top in the car, actually. But anyway, yes, they seemed incredibly camp and terrified of my act. And then when I came back the next night, and every night after, they kept using a blue pen arrow to move me in the bill, to move me to the middle or closing the first half. They were trying to bury my act after seeing it once. Uh-huh. And Jason Wood said, and put Jason in as a headliner, which he easily could have headlined. Jason Wood's a brilliant comedian. I never didn't see him rip the roof off. And he told the producers, he was really in their favor too. They really adored him. Mm-hmm. And they wanted him back. They made it clear. And he said, I'm not closing the show. Scott should close the show every night. He's the closer. I really admire that about Jason. And he said to me at lunch a few days later, can't you just be entertaining? Do you have to be challenging? Do you have to be confrontational?
You have to
be
more thoughtful.
Yeah. I said to Jason, as much as I love Jason's act, you know, I think to Jason, the thought of offending an audience member would have been horrifying. And I said, and that's not my thought anyway. But I said, Jason, I don't see the point of that. I don't. I mean, not for myself. You know, later on, there was a comic on the bill, not on our show, but in the festival, who I really liked. And he was with us at lunch that day. He's since become a big TV star in this country. Very attractive man.
Who's Welsh.
I can't tell you who. Anyway,
he's Welsh. Welsh. He's very attractive.
Very attractive.
Hair color?
Dark.
Eyes?
Welsh. And yeah, he's beautiful. And well, I think he is. Anyway, he had been a financial trader before he became a comic and was successful.
Any more about him? I'm sure we can identify him.
Very smart. And got a TV show on. Anyway, so yes, he said the same. And then later on, we all got high at the hotel and played Spin the Bottle. And the bottle went to Rod. So he and I went out on the deck because my challenge to him was do a lap dance.
Oh, right. That's a...
And
was that a dare rather than the truth? So he wouldn't tell
you. Okay. He wouldn't talk about himself. But he already had. He mentioned some very interesting things about his.
Is that why you asked him to do
own sexual behavior when he was a teenager? Because claimed to be, you know, had a bisexual phase.
Okay.
Rod did. So he went out on the deck, and whatever town he's from in Wales, a lap dance is naked. So he made them close the curtains to the deck in the hotel, and he stripped.
Okay. Yeah.
And sat on my lap for about 3 minutes and held me. Anyway, I thought, God, all these
was that long enough, Scott?
But just long enough. Okay, yeah, I finished good. Right about around that.
He was pretty attractive.
So beautiful. And I thought, why doesn't he talk about this part of his personality's act? Or the teenagers he mentioned where he used to bang guys on his ping pong table, or he's straight now, I guess, but who cares? Why is he? All this stuff is so interesting. He's a fine comic, but let's see, this is why I don't have my own TV show, because I'm not Welsh, but also because that's the stuff I would have talked about.
Yeah.
Because that's my own personal story. I always think if an audience gets offended, you can defend yourself if it's your own journey. Then you could just say, but this is my story. Well, I'm not, who am I offending? Except myself, and I'm not. So if you don't like it, you know, cover your ears. But that's why I don't. When I meet people and I tell them I'm a comedian, oftentimes people get nervous because they're like, "Oh, don't talk about me in your show."
You're gonna write because I know I'm really weird and I know I'm gonna be really stupid. I know I'm gonna be really funny.
It's really interesting.
You just can make jokes about me.
Well, I just do the old Joan Rivers line where like, "Don't worry, I've got hours. I don't need you." You're not. She told that to Bo Derek. Anyway, I don't need you. You're out. You're out of the act. And because you know, there's a lot going on to talk about. And I don't think I would waste my time on most people I know. Why would I talk about them? For one thing, the audience doesn't know who anyone I know is, unless they're famous, and I don't talk about famous people in my act. Yeah. I see a lot of comics doing that now. That's a real thing now. Mm-hmm. Comics talking about, oh, I went to lunch with, or I was just on the road with, or I hang out with. It happens a lot in London, which is so strange to me because the British are so kind of laid back about celebrity. But it's becoming a thing on comedy stages.
I must be fair. I've never heard that at our comedy club.
Not your club. No. It wouldn't happen there.
Cool.
But it happens a lot. And I see a lot at my husband's club at the Top Secret. And it's weird to me because I think, but why would you bother? Anyway, so I don't talk about it. Yeah. It's either about me or my family.
I'm sure they just haven't watched them on television. They just want to try and turn it into a personal anecdote. And actually, they're more boring than they think they are.
It might. But you know, I just think, why would I reveal something about someone that you really admire, who's a celebrity, who has this persona? I'm not going to break that persona down or damage it. Yeah. I wouldn't bother. But also, yeah, it's that what you're watching isn't even real. You're so far removed from what's going on. And I want things. I think my relationship with the audience has to be intimate. It has to be intimate, or else none of it's going to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to feel as if. It has to not just feel like I'm opening a door. Mm-hmm. It has to feel like I'm opening several doors and letting them into the you know, the private space, wherever mm-hmm. that is. And they're guests, you know, and they need to be treated as such. And not as, this isn't an artificial happening. This is actually happening when it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no point pretending that what's going on around us isn't happening. And if people go to a comedy club to escape, I would suggest they don't do that. It's not an escapist route. If you want to, you know, go see, you know, a musical or a play, there's loads you can do to avoid. Go to a sauna or a sex club or the, you know, the places you go to, or the pools or whatever you call them. Or go, you know, go on a bike ride or go to Pilates class, do something else. But the point of the comedy thing is that's going to be immediate. That's going to be the opposite of what you're trying to do, which is escaping.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the polar version of that. So we all make mistakes. If I call you a woman, you have to fucking forgive me. Forgive Louis C.K. Forgive people for making fucking mistakes. If that is a mistake, are you a woman, Adam?
Yes.
Well, there you are, I'm right. But if you buy a penis, it makes sense because it pays for itself in 2 years. The thing is,
I'm just warning you now, the surgery is difficult, just so you know. You know how they do it, right? They take the vagina and they talk some sense into it.
So I'm just saying.
So what about, you know, one of the things you mentioned to me earlier on is that there are comedians who are really using their comedy and their time on stage to confront their own demons. I mean, you know, is that part of what you do, Scott, or you think that's...
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think I'm trying to figure out my relationship with my father right now. I'm writing a show about it, and I understand. I just saw him, and I understand it even less now than I did 3 weeks ago before I went to California. I feel like it's kind of the only place that you can talk about certain subjects. And really, when I talk about kids with learning disabilities on stage, I'm doing it because I'm trying to understand why people still have such a problem with talking about kids with learning disabilities. Mm-hmm. I mean, none of us have picked that kid up by their ankles and slammed them against a brick wall. It's not our fault that they, whatever happened to them, you know, some learning disabilities are, you know, happen at birth or before birth, mm-hmm. or during developmental years or because of an accident. It's just so odd to me that people don't want to talk, you know. I mean...
So you're picking that subject as a way of exploring our response to it.
Hypocritical response.
Which is an awkward or hypocritical response.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in 89, I was hit by a car. My head was split open. And I didn't know where I was. I was in a coma for a while. And when I came out, my family was pretty sure that I was going to be like, you know, a bit damaged and stuff. And they wanted to give me a test. Like, I worked, eventually, about a year later, weirdly, I worked... in the department to which I've been administered as a patient.
Okay.
I worked for this guy, Roger Simon, who's the head of the department, actually, for neurology. And they wanted at the time, he said, wouldn't it be, because I was able to read my notes. The doctor had written notes about me as a patient. And I was able to read them, which were quite disturbing. And
they'd re-injected your brain through your ear.
They said he should be tested. Well, you should be, right? Because there are photos of me. Well, there are photos of me when I went home. I still have blood coming out of my ears. It's American, you know, medical system. When you're awake, get out. We need the bed. But they wanted to test to see if my cognitive responses had been damaged, or to see if my short-term memory had been damaged, and to see if I could literally put a triangle shape into a triangle space.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger said it'd be interesting to do those tests now, because we didn't do them then, just to see if there was any long-lasting damage. I'm mm-hmm. like, I don't want to do any of it. Because once in most cases, when brain cells have been damaged, they don't regenerate. You're not mm-hmm. going to get that back. It's gone. So
did you, are you a bit triangle phobic?
I am a little bit. If I can't think of a word, or I have a little bit... Or I stutter a bit. My friend Julie reassures me I've always been like this. I really freak out and assume that I'm going to, you know, have an aneurysm immediately. I mean, I was really injured badly.
Yeah.
And I always oftentimes think that maybe I should... It's one of these questions I have about myself on stage. Like, am I so eager to prove that I'm with it and not held back by anything?
Mm-hmm.
By my own potential brain damage, by...
This happened a long time ago.
It did, Scott. Yeah.
I think you've probably proven to yourself and tens of thousands of people
but it's
that
why,
actually your brain is fully functional.
But I have to tell you, it's why I don't go on stage with notes. I see a lot of comics do it, even new material, and I won't do it.
Yeah.
I force myself to memorize it because the memory was a real thing they were worried about with me.
Yeah.
And I'm determined to maintain whatever memory I have left. If it was damaged, I don't want to know. But when I see comics on stage with notes, I can't watch. I have to leave the room. Yeah. It makes me really, really tense. As an audience member, it makes me tense because I'm worried they're going to forget where they are. And that's a real fear for me. I cannot forget what I'm doing because I have a thread I'm flowing. And if I forget and the audience has a second too much to think about what I'm saying, I know I always fear that I'll lose them.
You are so quick. Sometimes I actually miss some of the jokes that you're saying. And I have the luck, you know, I go back and watch a video. You're so fast.
Well, I try to keep it moving quickly because I don't want them to... I don't want this set to lose momentum. It's the least I can do. It's only 20 minutes long usually in London. But also, I'm really I'm very trepidatious about the idea of falling back.
Right.
Really nervous about it. So anything I say, I like to do callbacks, although I think audiences are getting a bit narrow in terms of callbacks. I think their memories, I think the audience's memory is diminishing a bit. But I also, I feel a bit like, I do love callbacks, and I love comics that can do them effectively. But I really like to move forward from one step to the next. I want to sound a bit nuts. Not I want to, but I assume when people listen to me that I sound a bit
dangerous.
Just a bit.
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
All good. Well, this is. Yeah. I better pay attention.
But socially, I've been lectured by a couple of my friends through the years about how I behave. And it's been really, a friend of mine really thinks that I've been made nicer by my marriage, that it's calmed me down a bit. But all I've had to do is, because I've lost a couple of friends, is I've had to, in social situations, remember that in most of those situations, the people in the room don't know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know that I'm a comic. They may not have a sense of humor about themselves. I mean, I've been banned from parties and stuff and kicked out of people's homes. Like I tell you, my mom kicked me out of her house once.
That's
happened a number of times.
Yeah.
Where I've said, I've been threatened. I felt threatened by something someone said to me. And my first response is to
be aggressive.
Yeah, that's why when someone yelled at me at the Comedy Store, we talked about it last year, they said they were going to kill me. It came out of the dark. It's beginning of my set. I just walked on stage and this guy said, I'm going to kill you. And then he repeated it. And I really went after him verbally. I really fucking let the mask down. I did not withhold. And at first the audience was like, yeah, you do it. You get him. But then 5 minutes later, I think they were worried for me. They were concerned about my mental health. And I never got them back. I really learned, maybe 2 years ago, I was following Jack Whitehall actually. And I really learned, and he had been brilliant, of course. And I think that they were lulled into this feeling of safety and warmth by his act. And yeah. I came out and just screamed at them for 5 minutes. And I think one thing I need to do, remember in my personal and professional life, and maybe this is why I seem nicer now because I've been on the road for so long, is to not take anything personally. And when I was just in California, someone said to me, it was just last Saturday night, I was on stage doing a compilation show. It wasn't my show, but I was closing a show called Cheaper Than Therapy. It's a really great show in San Francisco. Okay. And they just changed the seating and moved the seats closer to the stage. And they put a mic and mic stand in the show. It used to be more theatrical. Anyway, so I'm really close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was chatting with an 18-year-old Jewish boy in the front row. He's adorable. And I looked to his right, and someone who might have been a friend of his, I'm not sure, a bit older than maybe 25, was on his cell phone. I don't just mean checking the phone, but punching away, just really on it. Right there.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman next to him might have been a friend of his, I'm sure she was, had her feet on the stage, resting back. I let that go, which is not like me, but I only had between 15 and 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like 11 o'clock at night, which is late for dinner. It's a sleepy little town. And this kid, and I said, hey, turn it off. Turn it off now. I'm not going to babysit you, but turn that fucking thing off. And he said, whoa. I'm like, there's people around you. You're distracting them. It's not about me. It's about them. Everybody paid.
Mm-hmm.
Let them enjoy the show. And then it got quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Because 25-year-olds are not accustomed to being told no.
That's right. That's very true.
And so he got, well, no, you've made it awkward. I'm like, no, you might find that you've made it awkward.
No, you're a dick.
Yeah, that you made it awkward. I said, what do you do for a living?
Living?
Just trying to, yeah, exactly. Just trying to lighten it up a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I'm homeless. And I said, you know what I know you are now is you're not from here, are you? No, I'm not. I said, because you'll find that locals in San Francisco, we don't joke about homelessness. It's a fucking serious problem here. And it got quieter, and I thought, how can I fix this? And I said, anyway, I see what you're trying to do. You know I own a home. I already told you I did. And you're just trying to get back with me. But I'm married. Although your strategy is working very well. And then I turned it into a flirtation.
Yeah, yeah, cool.
Otherwise, it was near the end of my set. I would have lost them. You cannot take it. This little dickweed doesn't know who the fuck I am. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm sure when I said I was 57, he thought, God, that's my grandfather's age. So he just got on the phone. Why would he, this is some old queer in San Francisco, rattle on about his gay cock? I feel the same way sometimes. So I understand his perspective. But again, you know, I've got to make it so that, for one thing, he doesn't win. And the only way I think really to do that is to not take it to heart.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
So when I'm going on about current events and stuff, I remember after Diana died, I was hosting a TV show. We were in Norwich, of all places. And I went on to do the first 10-minute warm-up for the audience. Mm-hmm. And it was just like 3 weeks after Diana died. And I did some Diana material. a lot of it. And some audience members leaving the taping were like, we enjoyed the show, but that Dinah stuff was a bit severe. And I said,
I would have loved it. I wish I'd have seen it.
I said, now or never. And I said, also, she would have liked it because she was a media whore. And they're like, okay, you're kind of right. I mean, you know, I think that people in the media, people who are involved in experience going on in front of you, I think most people have a story they're dying to tell. And the only way to tell a story now is to be, is to do something outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
And if something is done outrageously, like the way Trump governs, mm-hmm. or the way your current prime minister governs, or any of them, mm-hmm. really,
mm-hmm.
Putin, Bolsonaro, I mean, you have to make fun of them. Mm-hmm. That's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like you, well, like you said, Boris is a performer.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, he is. And as is Trump, and there are lots of showmen around.
We're just trying to keep up.
But that's right. But I would like people to make... I would like people to make jokes about different targets because there are so many performers around. I mean, Guy Verhofstadt's a performer. You know, Ursula von der Leyen is a performer. they're all in a performance.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does tend to go a bit one way and become a little bit...
Greta, that Greta girl on the boat.
Greta!
She's a performer.
Greta is so well managed. You know, dad is effectively a manager now.
Oh,
sponsored by Tesla. I mean, it's amazing.
It's outrageous.
And all the people applauding her are performing, putting on a performance.
Tesla's so brilliant, though. God, I wish I thought of it. It's so good. It's so good. I mean, she's never gonna. No one will ever please her. She'll never love.
It's gonna be funny when she changes her mind, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when she just
like, when she wakes
she
up,
she actually gets a boyfriend. And it's like, do you know what? She just go out and party now, and it's like
when she finds a doctor.
All this climate crap.
You know? Or when she finds a doctor that forces her parents to cut back on the medication. God, she's so medicated, little things. The dead eyes, her little dead eyes, her little scary dead eyes, and her ponytail.
Oh, my God. Oh, is your next sketch coming up?
maybe I should write about her being in rehab. You should. Yeah, I will.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good one.
Well, you know, it's sometimes the audience doesn't know. Like I did this political improv show at the Comedy Store. We've talked about it, yeah. And the audience half the time doesn't know what the current stories are.
Really?
Well, because they haven't read the paper in a week. They're busy. People have jobs and kids and shit. Yeah, they haven't picked up, you know, they haven't gone on there, or if they have, they've read Pot Bitch. They've read some sort of celebrity garbage. Sure. Or they read the Daily Mail because it's funny. And they haven't really, you know. So, you know, we have to kind of re-educate them a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So you tackle all sorts of issues, you know, Islamic jihadis, Mormons dying, you know, paedophile and all the rest of it.
Mm.
But you said that you're working on stuff around your dad.
Yeah, I am. You know this girl that went to Afghanistan from Bethnal Green?
Yes, Shamima Begum.
Mm. I'm writing a little bit about her because she's been, as you know, abandoned by the UK government, and she's,
Syria, sorry, it was. Wasn't it?
But the UK government has taken her, they're threatening to, or they have removed her citizenship,
mm-hmm.
which is illegal as far as the UK government is concerned, because they signed a pact with the EU and with the rest of the world, really, saying that if someone had a single nationality, that it was illegal, and it was British.
I think it's a UN thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's about making people stateless.
Yeah, so she's stateless right now. Stateless. So she's in an incredibly precarious position. She's in a very dangerous state, which they put mm-hmm. her. And so I'm writing about how unbelievably envious I am of her. How all the choices she has, and the lack of responsibility, and how I'm trying to make it into, you know, obviously something funny, but how without a family, how free I would feel, and how wonderful Christmas must have been for her to not have to call anybody or drop anyone's house.
No thank you letters.
Nothing. Like no gifts you have to accept and then return the next fucking day. That's a nightmare. Like shit, you know, she could have gone out to lunch, seen a film, no one would have questioned her. She's got the world's her oyster. And thank you, UN. Thank you. Thank you, British government. So I like, what's the difference? Like, that seems to be what I want, and what would that really be like? Because I had to spend the holiday with my father, with him, you know, passed out in a Lazy Boy lounger that heats. He got one with a heater.
Wow.
So he never...
gently vibrate as well.
Oh, he never moves. And he was choking on a pill and wouldn't get up to get a glass of water. When I walked into this house. He'd been choking for a while, sitting in the chair choking. So...
Did you just stand there and say, well, when you finish that?
Yeah. Can I give you another one? And, you know, I just, my family are so fucking crazy. My sister's like, you know, it'll fix Dad. I said, well, a coffin. And she said, no, no, Gatorade. What do you mean, Liz? Well, he's dehydrated. Well, that's because he's an alcoholic who just drinks coffee. No, it's because he doesn't like the taste of water.
Oh, right.
Because water has so much flavor. Yeah. So she said,
mixed with whiskey.
Yeah. She said, what he needs is Gatorade. That'll fix it. The Gatorade fixed him. I'm like, who knew? The marketing power Gatorade has been ignoring. So this is right before the doctor told us he has 3 kinds of cancer. Anyway, Gatorade fixes cancer. The point is, that was just one moment with my family. And, you know, I leave and go see friends. The next day, they're like, why do you look so tired? Because I just spent the day with the vacuum that is my, you know, so it's like I'm trying to write about my father.
It sounds like there's loads of material.
Hopefully. Absolutely loads. But if you don't have a family, what do you do? Who are you? You know, I don't know who, I'm really angry at Britain right now because for the way it's dealing with their current situation.
What with the
friendly
Americans particularly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm really fucking pissed off at the fact that you can't have a conversation about Trump in the US at all. You cannot. Right. Either you fucking hate him. I've realized, you know, I've had to go on stage now instead of trying to be ironic about Trump, I just have to say at the beginning of my sets there, hour-long sets, look, let's kill him, let's have him murdered. And that is all, you know, I don't sanction, you know, public murdering or government-led killing, but, you know, if I don't do that, the audience is resistant on and off to me for an hour, and I just can't have that for an hour. Mm. So I just, I wonder what it would like to be stateless and homeless.
Yeah.
How freeing that would be.
Or you know, you'd just be loved everywhere, Scott. Mm. That's the thing. You don't need a passport to just walk into a country. Actually, you do, don't you? Because they just pick on you.
Unless you get $1 million and you go wherever you want.
There's a particular woman, isn't there, on border control, just looks out for you.
Yeah.
Bloody Scott Capurro.
There he is again. But yeah.
Bloody nail him.
I mean,
just takes a piss.
I can't imagine having children. I mean, that woman that we talked about, Shamima.
Shamima, yeah.
I mean, she had to kill her kids to get to where she is now, you know? Because they were standing in the way of her happiness. But, in the Middle East, it's okay.
Doesn't her husband give her a head full of bins for last Christmas? Oh, well, they stopped, she doesn't celebrate Christmas as such, but around that period of time.
She's completely traumatized, but imagine if you've been traumatized and then had to go live with your family in Bethnal Green. Jesus Christ. She's better off. Anyway, so I think she's in northern Syria or Turkey somewhere, maybe. But anyway, I just feel like, the lesser of two evils. I mean, I'm trying to establish a family for myself, and I've realized I'm trying to do it, so I don't have to spend time with my other family, which is, you know, the one I was born with. Because I can use my husband as an excuse. He's a great excuse. I can say, you know, I can't. I said I have plans. That shuts people right up if you say your husband you have plans. Yeah, they stop asking. So, but my husband is on my nerves too. So I don't know.
So when are we going to see this?
Living in a cardboard box. It might be the only way out.
Oh, Scott, I come and give you little sandwiches and stuff and a little flask of coffee.
Well, they barbecue now. San Francisco, I went to play a comedy club on Hyde Street, the Tenderloin, and it's always been a bit rough, the Tenderloin, but it goes through fits and starts. And there were tents all the way along both sides of the street, and I'm like, what's that smoke? And they were cooking. I'm like, oh, that's sweet. And they were selling stuff, but the stuff isn't bad because they're ripping off, they're doing so many house break-ins in California now, and they're stealing really nice shit and then selling it for like $5. So if you need a new computer or a diamond bracelet or a fucking Rolex,
so you're talking about tents of homeless people?
Yes, literal tents, not just kind of a blanket over a stick, right, but real nice, nice tents. Like they're nailed into the cement and the police drive by very slowly. But there's a law in San Francisco that the homeless cannot be touched. You cannot physically remove them with a touch. They have to agree to go with you. If you're a cop, you're going to arrest them. So
they're talking about propositioning homes.
No, maybe.
So I was going down the side of the wrong path there, Scott.
But they nail their tents into
consent.
The ground.
Yeah, yeah. I know I'm homeless. Even though I'm homeless, you've got to actually ask me first.
Yes,
and then we sign the form.
You have to ask before you. Yeah.
And you come in my tent.
Well, some of the homeless are hot, but anyway, because they've been pushing that cart all day long. But yes, they, you know, they're making little communities like in India where people have lived on the corner for generations and things like that now.
Well, so there you go. Blimey.
I actually saw someone I knew
Did you?
That I used to do comedy
with. Ex-teacher?
No, he was a comedian about, this is 20 years ago.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it was him.
Is he still funny?
Unintentionally. I mean, I think it was him. I mean, I couldn't, I'd never seen him without
shoes. You didn't go and talk to him?
I felt,
Scott, what's the matter with you? Well, you just looked at him and you just thought, I'm so embarrassed and so awkward.
I felt sad.
Why didn't you just go and say, would you like a tin of beans or something?
I was wearing
Paul Smith. Can I buy you a coffee?
I was wearing Paul Smith suede shoes. I afraid he'd throw up on me. So I just left it. I felt terrible.
I feel bad about it now.
Awful man.
If it was a woman, I would have said hello. Because I'm worried about homeless females. I think they're much more in danger. Yeah. I might have
endangered.
They are in danger.
Yeah. It's not equality, is it?
They're like
people
unicorns.
Go on and on about equality, but actually there are far more homeless men than women.
There are.
So to get true equality in this world, we need more homeless women.
You have to get a fire more women.
We should campaign for homeless
it's
women.
It's terrible. And you know, it was strange. I thought that a lot of people think that the homeless problem in California is a race problem as well. But it's, from what I can see, that's equally shared.
Gentrification
problem. Yeah, thank God for that. Yeah, there is all sorts. I even saw
house price problem probably slightly as well.
But yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to write jokes about homelessness, obviously, because when this guy confronted me about it on Saturday, I thought, I need 5 minutes on that.
Yeah.
So.
You do, got to be contemporary. Issues that aren't people
well,
aren't talking about.
Well, it's going to come
in
up.
A different way.
It's a really
and
big.
And offend everybody, Scott.
It's a real, it's such a knee-jerk thing in California, too. People think they have the answer. Everyone thinks they have the answer to
it. Oh, right, okay.
We need to worry about their psychological health, or we need to worry about their mental health status, blah, blah. What they need is a house. They're homeless.
Yeah.
You need to put them indoors.
Yeah, like a cheap one that can afford.
Anything, because then a lot of the problems go away when that happens.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Well,
you know, homeless, it's there's no
they don't
home.
Have a, no, seriously. And they need caretakers, some of them, obviously. They need people checking the medication and all that. But what they need are four walls and a roof first.
It's
and then,
cheap and they can afford it. That's right.
So.
Be a good start.
I hope so.
So, are you on tour soon, Scott?
Yes,
are you going to Edinburgh? Or?
I'm going to Amsterdam and then Berlin and Dusseldorf.
Are you doing comedy when you're there, yeah?
I am.
That's great.
Yeah. And then back to California. And then...
are you going
to
go see your dad again?
I'm...
okay.
It's such a
I shouldn't
long
have
drive.
Reminded you, sorry.
I know. Okay. I wish... When you're old, can I give you some advice? Because you're old. And you have kids. When you get, like in 10 years, don't move farther away. Don't do that.
No.
No. Stay close. Because you're old.
To who?
To your kids.
Oh, kids, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, of course
because
will, yeah.
Well, you need help.
They're not going to look after me.
Well, but they might want
to... My daughter said to me, "said when you're at a certain stage, I'm going to put you in a home and I'm going to feed vegan food, mushed up vegan food through to a straw and you're going to be incapacitated." She's threatened that to me for the last 2 years.
But,
so I'm going to get as far away from her as I can.
A home! Might not be so bad. We found some nice homes for my dad. Some of them in California, they've got golf and tennis.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you want your home to be like?
I don't want golf or tennis.
No, what do you, not
just
our vegan food.
I just want my family around me, actually.
Well, then don't move far away.
If she gets that tube anywhere near my fantasy, I'm going to be tripping her up with my cane.
Well, my father's got tubes up his nose now, and he's on a walker with, tennis balls on
the
bottom.
Is that for the whiskey?
Yeah. Just pour
ice cubes in one.
I mean, so we can, and he has to leave the oxygen tank to go out and smoke. He only gets 15-minute breaks.
Leave the oxygen tank.
Seriously,
to smoke.
It's a disaster.
That is brilliant.
Oh my God. So,
why doesn't he just put smoke in the oxygen tank? Why doesn't he just have fag tank? Sorry, fag as in
watch
the
it.
British version.
Yeah, yeah.
Of the,
I own a couple of fag tanks, actually. Yeah. Shouldn't be way too old for them. But anyway, I only wear them in yoga. But yeah, so he's, he's a mess and he needs help. So I just wish he hadn't, if he's just closer. But then if he's closer, I'd see him more often. I'd probably strangle him.
He'd be dead already, actually.
No, I'd use a really soft pillow, though, I would.
Yeah.
You know, I read a story about this guy. I wish I could remember the title of it. And one of the characters was a serial killer, a gay serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And he claimed, it's a story, it's a fiction, but this killer claimed that sometimes people don't fight back, that they give in when he killed them. When he strangled them.
Well, they're not really around there to refute that, are they?
But he claimed that they just didn't. It was interesting. He wrote a lot. I've read a lot about serial killers too.
Dennis Nielsen. Do you know what?
Personal favorite.
That is absolutely. My wife was obsessed with Dennis Nielsen.
Oh,
she's a psyche nurse, right?
All right.
And she's gone through
you
a bit
look
of a phase.
Like, a little bit like.
She's,
him,
she's
you
gone,
know that, right?
She's got. Hang on,
you do a little bit.
She had a bit of a thing about all these, psychopaths and serial killers and the rest of it. And Dennis Nielsen, I remember reading the Dennis Nielsen, a book about Dennis Nielsen, and she used to show me this picture, and it still is one of the funniest pictures I've ever seen. And it's one of those, it's an old Victorian wardrobe, and the wardrobe's open. There's a load of plastic bags in the wardrobe full of bits of bodies,
right,
with an Airwick freshener on top.
That's so sweet. It's hilarious.
It's still one of the funniest photographs I've ever seen.
Well, when they broke into Dahmer's house, Jeffrey Dahmer.
My God.
Seriously, respect. And when that was happening, I just started a comic. Almost my entire act was on Dahmer. But anyway, he painted some of the skulls. So when people came around, they thought it was art.
Wow, yeah. Yeah.
Because a painted skull can't be real.
Yeah.
So you paint them with like art, like an art paint, like white. But he'd leave them out.
Yeah.
So people could see them and comment on them. And then he pretended to have made them. And when he said in this interview I just read that he ate them because he wanted them inside. He wanted them closer.
Yeah. Nielsen just didn't want people to leave him.
Yeah.
Brought them back and just didn't want...
Dahmer said one of the guys had agreed to spend the night, which totally surprised him and threw him off. And after the guy spent the night, he walked into a bus stop because he'd spent the night with him. Yeah. But when these lovers would get up to leave, he'd be like, don't go. Drill in the head, right?
Yeah.
I know. He just wanted... It's super sweet. He just wanted to cuddle. That's all. He just
wanted to cuddle.
I know. And then if you wouldn't stay, he'd make you stay, but, you know, Scott, inside of him.
How did we get on to serial killers? I've slightly lost track of where we were going with this discussion.
But anyway, they're a great subject of comedy, actually. Yeah. They are. And, I wish we'd have it. We need a new fresh one. We haven't had one in a while. Although this guy that just raped...
What about the guy who's raped 179 people?
It's so homophobic. The whole coverage of it is. It's rife with homophobia. Yes! Have you read the story? Some guys hadn't known they'd been raped. And when the police tapped on the door a few years later and said, you've been raped, oh my God, they fell into a hole of depression. And excuse the word hole. And then before you know it, suddenly they've admitted to drinking too much and taking pills. Well, how did you get to this point? Because as I recall from the story, you were hammered when he picked you up and so drunk when you got back to his place you passed out because the police never found any drugs in his location. They claim, he must have used GBH or something like that to knock them out. But they never found a trace of any of it. So you're telling me that he used drugs to knock them out when he didn't have to. What he did was... brought guys home and fucked them. Right. And when they found out they were fucked, they fell into a vat of depression because suddenly they'd been raped. Have you been raped? Or did you just go back with somebody and as he's fucking you, you passed out? Oh, well, what is that? That's something different, isn't it, than being drugged into being raped? So, because you did consent a little because you laid down face down on his bed and felt him go inside of you. But then, you kind of fell asleep. Or they knocked on your door and your girlfriend just found out you fucked some guy after you got drunk one night. And you're going to blame the drugs, which they never found?
So what? Sorry,
he was a Samaritan. He only liked straight, he says, he only was attracted to straight guys of a certain age and background. Yeah. These straight guys went back to his house and he fucked them. And then when the police tapped on the door 3 years ago and said,
the police tap on these guys' door?
Because they found film footage on his phone of him fucking guys.
Right, and why were they looking at his phone?
Someone had reported that he'd banged them or tried to bang them or brought them back and attempted to bang him.
Right,
I think I'm getting that fact wrong.
Okay.
I should research that again.
Yeah.
Why do you think they were?
Why
were they checking his two phones? Because he had two.
I have no
idea. And they found the phones in the flat. He didn't try to hide them.
I have no idea.
Yeah. I'm saying is the reporting I've read so far
has
sounded... I'm not saying this is true, but there is a lot of jokes in this.
I think you need to find the jokes. This when you've got all the jokes.
Okay.
Because shagging 180 people or whatever.
I know, it's great. It's terrible.
No.
It's awful. It's rape. All right, cut it all out. Oh, jeez. I'm going to get in trouble.
Yeah. Okay.
But come on, the reporting... Come on.
I don't know.
Tap. You know this guy? Yeah, I know him.
Maybe he did rape a load of blokes.
Really? Because they were drunk?
But it's a lot of blokes to get through, really, to be fair.
A lot.
Yeah. And for one of them to complain 180 later.
Ouch.
There's probably quite a few blokes.
Okay, for one, can I say one thing, too? When I've been fucked, I've known the next day. There's ways you know.
Are there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can tell you two ways. Right. You shit out a butt full of cum. There's that.
No. I didn't actually ask you what the ways were,
when you
Scott.
When you poop the next day.
Scott, I'm not actually...
It's actually Scott, shaped like a penis. No, it is. The poop is shaped like a penis.
So,
yeah.
So what you're telling me?
Well, I'm just saying, these guys didn't know when they shat out a butt full of cum, they didn't think, oh, where did that come from?
There's
that.
Well, maybe he used a condom.
No, he didn't. He says he didn't.
Okay. So, yeah, maybe the...
I don't know. Okay, we'll cut all that.
I don't know. We can explore this.
I'll find it in a week and a half, and I'll report back to you. Yeah. I'll record it and send it to you.
Yeah, no, that's
suffice it to say.
I'm looking forward to your next set.
There is a serial.
It's mainly going to consist of your father, some male rapist, stroke not rapist,
and how angry I am about Brexit. This serial rapist. There's obviously. Potential comedy material in that. I just have to find it.
Rapist, Samaritan. Honestly, you're going to have to go from angel to devil, aren't you?
Yes, exactly. And you know, knock, knock.
Maybe just
yes,
it as
officer.
An experiment.
You were raped 3 years ago. Oh my God! Suddenly, because of that, I'm an alcoholic. I mean, every asshole needs an excuse, I guess. Anyway, so yes, we will research it and get back to you.
That sounds fantastic, Scott. It's been lovely talking to you. I'm really glad to have probed. You intellectually and
rape is bad.
I'm glad you mentioned
it. It's super bad.
I was starting to worry. Just an apologist.
No, I mean silver lining for some, but it's bad for most.
Sexual aggression.
It is. Yeah. It's a very bad thing to do.
Is it? Is it a bad thing to have done to you?
Yes.
That's the wrong way around.
Having a rape fantasy, I'm not going to judge.
Yeah.
But see, when I think of prison rape. Uh-huh. I think of these, you know, like a French guy who's been put in jail because he was a chef and he burned a sauce. I want that hot French guy.
Oh, yeah, naughty, naughty. Rather than some bloke who's passed out outside some shitty nightclub.
Right, and on the weekends he plays football and he's got big, big legs. And, of course, he's French, so a big dick. That's the guy who rapes me in prison.
Yeah, okay.
With his friends.
Do you not ever do the other
with the sous chef and the dessert chef. That's the guy. No, I don't. No, me? No. I'm a cum dumpster. But anyway, that's my thing. But my thing is never, like, my friend Don, who works for the prison system in California, he's like, that's not what it really looks like. The guys you meet in prison, no, they're disgusting. Most of them are crazy and don't bathe, or they have to be forced to bathe, or they're on meds and they're nuts, and they're not attractive at all.
They're missing
teeth, and they've suffered years of abuse probably in their own lives, so they're terrifying. He's like, none of them, no. You know, every so often.
You're just saying it's a fantasy and it's not actually.
Yeah. Because you see serial killers on TV and they're hot. I mean, you know, Dahmer or all of them. Yeah. And you think, you know, if someone were going to drill a small hole into the top of my head and pour lactic acid in, that's the guy I'd want to do it.
Well, and on that note.
Sorry. Anyway.
Scott, I was going to say it's been... Well, in fact, about five
I'm sure
minutes
we
ago,
all feel this way about rape, don't
no,
we?
No, we don't. Okay. I did say about 5 minutes ago, it was lovely talking to you, but I'm actually not sure now. And,
when you're next on, can you just let me know
and I'll make sure I'm drilling my own head or something.
Okay.
Cool.
Very small hole. He could have recovered, but anyway.
Lovely to talk to you, Scott.
You too.
No, it's all just... It's too much, right? I don't want to go to childhood that. And what if they're really flawed? Like, they can't defend themselves. You know what I mean? But, you know? What if they're, American? Or what if? What if they're, you know, I can't look after myself. I can't deal with someone who's got real issues. Like, you know, and a lot of people feel this way. They'll get all quiet and judge you fuckers after all you've been through tonight. Seriously, 90% of Down syndrome embryos are, you know, aborted. 90%, which makes sense why the 10% who survive are always smiling. Right? The winners! And they got huge cocks, you know this, right? Because the blood's not rushing to the brain, it's got to go somewhere, right? Like...
Oh, hi there. If you want to find this podcast on Twitter, you probably already have. But if you haven't, it's at Scott Cupuro, ScottCapuro. It's the same address on Facebook, where I'll hopefully be downloading this podcast, and all over social media. So take care and see you next week. Thanks. Bye.